The Catra Podcast Conversations for the Curious Essential Knowledge Simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of a Catra AI. Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, we're diving into something, well, fundamental. Why are humans so complicated? All the dating, the status games, fashion, art, just the sheer drama of it all.
A huge question. And Matt Ridley, in his really landmark book, The Red Queen, Sex and the Evolution of Human Nature, argues that a lot of it starts with this tiny biological puzzle, an inefficiency almost.
Right, the inefficiency of sex itself, which sounds weird, but when you look at the biology...
It's a paradox. I mean, think about it from a purely genetic accounting perspective. Asexual reproduction. You pass on 100% of your genes.
Yeah.
They're clones, perfectly adapted, presumably.
Makes sense. Asexual reproduction.
You immediately throw away half your genes. Only 50% get passed on. Plus, you have all the hassle and danger of, you know, finding a mate competing for them.
So it's like paying this huge 50% tax right off the bat. Biologically speaking, it's called the twofold cost of sex, and it's a massive handicap.
Exactly. You'd expect asexual organisms, the clones, to just rapidly outcompete anything that reproduces sexually. But clearly they haven't. We're still here.
Which means there must be a really powerful reason why sex persists, despite this cost.
Precisely. That cost demands a huge life or death kind of explanation. And that's our mission for this deep dive, to unpack Ridley's answer, the Red Queen hypothesis, and explore how this one idea, this defensive strategy, might have shaped, well, almost everything about us, our minds, relationships, even culture.
Okay, so before we get to the idea itself, who is Matt Ridley? What makes his take on this so compelling?
Well, he's got this interesting background. He has serious academic chops, a DPhil in zoology from Oxford, studying bird behavior, actually. Yeah. But he's also spent years as a science communicator, like being the science editor for The Economist.
Ah, so he bridges those two worlds, the deep science and making it understandable.
Exactly. And that's key here. He's not just reporting on evolutionary theory. He's a synthesizer. He takes these really complex, sometimes mathematical ideas from pioneers like W. D. Hamilton or Robert Trivers, big names in the field, and weaves them into this clear, really engaging story.
He makes it accessible.
Totally. He sort of translates the cutting edge of evolutionary psychology for a broader audience.
Yeah.
Reading The Red Queen, it feels like you're getting a glimpse into the, I don't know, the underlying logic of why we are the way we are.
Okay, let's get into that logic. The Red Queen hypothesis. The name itself is intriguing.
It comes straight from Lewis Carroll's Through the Looking Glass. Remember, the Red Queen tells Alice, it takes all the running you can do to keep in the same place.
Right. So it's about constant effort just to maintain your position, not even to get ahead.
Precisely. It captures this idea of a relentless coevolutionary arms race. We're constantly running, biologically speaking, just to stay level with our competitors.
And who are we racing against in this view?
Primarily, tiny things. Fast evolving parasites, bacteria, viruses, diseases. That's the core thesis.
Yeah.
Sex evolved and persists mainly as a defense mechanism against these microscopic enemies.
Okay, how does that work? If you're an asexual organism, a clone.
You're genetically identical generation after generation. So if a pathogen, say, a nasty bacteria, figures out the key to unlock your immune defenses.
It can wipe out the whole lineage.
Yeah.
Because everyone has the same lock.
Exactly. You're a sitting duck. A stable, predictable target. But sex shuffles the deck.
Ah, by mixing genes from two parents.
Right. Each offspring is genetically unique, a new combination of locks and defenses. So the pathogens that crack the parents' defenses, they basically have to start all over again with the kids. Sex creates a moving target.
So we pay that 50% genetic cost, so that twofold cost in the short term.
They gain this massive long-term advantage. It makes the species much more resilient to being wiped out by disease. It's an anti-extinction strategy, essentially.
That's a powerful idea. Is there evidence for it beyond the theory?
Oh, yeah. Ridley builds a strong case. One of the most compelling examples he details involves these freshwater snails in New Zealand, Potamopyrgus antipodarum.
Snails? Okay.
Yeah, these snails are perfect because they can actually switch. They can reproduce sexually or asexually.
Yep.
Like a natural experiment.
So what did researchers find?
Well, they looked at different streams. In streams where the snails were heavily infected with parasitic worms, lots of disease pressure, the snails overwhelmingly chose to reproduce sexually.
Okay.
But then just upstream, in areas where those parasites weren't really present, where it was safer.
Let me guess, they switched to asexual reproduction.
Bingo. Almost entirely asexual. It's like a direct correlation. High parasite threat, more sex. Low threat, more cloning. It strongly suggests sex is maintained specifically because of that parasite pressure. It's the Red Queen race in action.
Wow. Okay, so sex is crucial for defense. But then, Ridley argues, something else happens. Once sex is the norm, a new force takes over.
Exactly. This is where sexual selection comes in. The game changes. It's not just about survival anymore, natural selection. It becomes about reproductive success. Who gets to mate? The reproduction of the sexiest, you could say.
And the classic example here is the peacock's tail.
Yes, right? The perfect illustration. That tail is huge, bright, cumbersome. It makes the peacock worse at surviving, realistically. It's heavy, makes it slow, easy for predators to spot.
So why have it? It seems counterintuitive from a survival perspective.
Well, according to Almaz Zahavi's handicap principle, that's precisely the point. The tail is what's called an honest signal.
Honest signal, meaning?
It's a signal of genetic quality that's hard to fake because it's costly. The female peacock is essentially observing, wow, if this guy can survive and lug around that ridiculous expensive tail, he must have amazing genes. He must be really robust, have a great immune system.
So the handicap itself proves his quality. Only a really fit male could afford such a burden.
Exactly. So she's not choosing the most efficient male, maybe, but the one with the best underlying genes, the best defenses for that Red Queen race against disease. The handicap reveals fitness.
Okay, that makes sense for peacocks. How does this apply to us, to human relationships?
Well, Ridley brings in Bateman's principle here. It highlights a fundamental asymmetry between the sexes in terms of reproduction.
Okay.
For males, historically, reproductive success is potentially limited, mainly by the number of fertile females they can access. Sperm is cheap, biologically speaking, so there's a potential payoff for quantity and competition.
Right. More partners could mean more offspring.
Yeah. But for females, it's different. Eggs are costly. Mm. Pregnancy is a huge investment. Nursing takes time and energy. So female reproductive success is limited more by access to resources and the quality of the investment in each offspring.
So this sets up a kind of conflict of interest, the battle of the sexes.
You could frame it that way. Ridley suggests males might have an evolved inclination towards competition, status seeking, maybe even promiscuity, what's called a polygynous tendency. More potential partners.
And females?
Females face a balancing act. They need good genes, think the attractive, high-status peacock type. But also, crucially, they need reliable paternal investment, the provider who will stick around and help raise the very costly offspring.
So trying to get the best of both worlds, potentially, good genes and good resources.
It's a strategic challenge. And Ridley argues that where we see monogamy in human societies, it's often a kind of social arrangement, perhaps more beneficial to or driven by female interests. It essentially channels male resources and competition towards investing in a single family unit.
Okay, that's already pretty far-reaching, but then Ridley makes an even bigger leap, doesn't he? About the human mind itself.
He does. This is probably the most striking, maybe controversial part of the book. He proposes that our huge, complex brains, our intelligence, our creativity, these are essentially the human equivalent of the peacock's tail.
Our brains are like the peacock's tail. How?
Well, think about it. Our brains are incredibly expensive organs. They consume something like 20% of our resting energy. That's a massive biological cost. Why have them?
For survival, problem solving, tool use.
Partly, sure. But Ridley argues that a huge chunk of our mental capacity evolved not just for survival, but for courtship through sexual selection.
So things like language, art, music, humor, telling stories.
Exactly. All these complex, often non-survival-oriented abilities. He argues they function as costly displays. They showcase our underlying intelligence, our creativity, our genetic fitness to potential mates.
Wow. So witty conversation is basically a mating display, like the peacock showing off its feathers.
That's the essence of the argument. Our minds evolved in an intellectual arms race, driven by the need to attract, impress, and outcompete rivals in the mating market. Culture, in this view, is downstream of courtship competition.
That really reframes things. It connects our biology directly to, well, almost everything we consider uniquely human culture.
It ties it all together, yeah. Back to that Red Queen race against disease, driving the need for sex, which then unleashes sexual selection, which sculpts not just bodies, but minds too.
Okay, let's take a step back. What are the main sort of big picture themes or messages someone should take away from this deep dive into the Red Queen?
Well, first, definitely the core idea. Sexual selection is the architect of human nature. We often think evolution is all about survival of the fittest, right? But Ridley really hammers home how much of us, our desires, our intelligence, our social behaviors, was shaped by the competition for mates, not just the struggle to stay alive.
Right. We're built to attract, not just to endure. And that connects to another point, doesn't it, about what we find attractive?
Absolutely. The biological roots of attraction. It pushes back against the idea that beauty is purely subjective or just a social construct. Ridley argues that when we perceive beauty, things like facial symmetry, clear skin, certain body proportions, we're actually unconsciously picking up on reliable signals of underlying health and genetic quality, low parasite load, good developmental stability.
Things that would have mattered a lot in that evolutionary arms race.
Hugely. And maybe the most direct biological link he discusses is this idea about smell, that we choose mates partly by smell. Oh. And what we're smelling is their immune system.
Seriously? How does that work?
It's about these genes called the major histocompatibility complex, MHC. They govern a key part of our immune response. The idea is we're subconsciously drawn to partners whose MHC genes are different enough from our own.
Why different?
Because mixing different immune system genes gives offspring the broadest possible defense toolkit against a wider range of parasites, more variety, better protection.
So when people talk about chemistry with someone, they might literally be talking about immune system compatibility.
That's the implication. It's a fascinating, kind of weirdly romantic biological idea, isn't it?
It really is. Okay, so these are deep evolutionary drivers. How do they play out today in modern life? Can we see the Red Queen effect now?
Oh, definitely. Ridley's framework offers a lens to understand a lot of modern behavior. Think about decoding status and display. Why the obsession with luxury brands, huge houses, fancy cars.
Keeping up with the Joneses.
Or, through the Red Queen lens, its conspicuous consumption functioning like a modern peacock's tail. It's a costly signal saying, look how successful I am. I have so many resources, I can afford to waste them on this expensive, impractical thing. It broadcasts fitness to the mating market, essentially applying the handicap principle to our economy.
Huh. So a Ferrari isn't just a car, it's a very expensive feather display.
Kind of, yeah. And it connects to public health, too. The Red Queen in public health. Why do we need a new flu shot every year?
Because the flu virus evolves so fast, it's running its own race against our defenses.
Exactly. We're constantly playing catch-up. It also highlights the dangers of, say, agricultural monocultures, fields of genetically identical crops. They become incredibly vulnerable if one pathogen cracks their code. Or the overuse of antibiotics, which just accelerates the evolution of resistant bacteria. We're always in this arms race.
Okay, if you had to boil the whole book down to one core message.
I think it's that idea of the universal treadmill. Life, at many levels, requires constant effort, constant innovation, just to stay in the game. Whether it's biological evolution against parasites, or maybe even businesses competing in a market, or scientists pushing knowledge forward. Stagnation isn't really an option in a dynamic competitive system. You have to keep running.
Yeah, that resonates. For me, the thing that really lingered was the sheer audacity of the argument about the mind. The idea that our highest creative faculties, art, music, literature, philosophy even, might have their evolutionary roots firmly planted in the muck of sexual competition. That civilization is in some deep way one long, elaborate courtship display. Okay. It's provocative.
It definitely is. And I think that's the critical point for anyone listening. Understanding this evolutionary history, why we might have these deep-seated drives for status, attraction, competition. It's not about saying that's how we should act or that it excuses bad behavior. Not at all.
It's descriptive, not prescriptive.
Exactly. It's about providing the knowledge, the context for why we feel the things we feel, why society is structured in certain ways. Having that self-awareness, understanding those underlying scripts, that's what gives us the power to potentially make more conscious, more informed choices about how we navigate our lives today.
A really powerful framework for understanding human nature, starting from that simple puzzle of why sex exists. A fascinating deep dive. See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.